Cool. Okay. Yeah. So I'm Nick Cowan at the University of Washington. So I'm going to talk about Epoxy, which is this mission that Dave just mentioned that ended up being the extension to the Deep Impact mission after Deep Impact had done its thing. Okay. And so the idea is to use Epoxy to look at Earth. If my slides decide they want to progress forward, let's try that one again. I think the switching of the projectors. There we go. Oh no, I'm good with the space bar. Okay. The point is that this is what we want to mimic, is looking at a planet when it looks like that. So here goes. Here's my motivation in two slides. So there's these things called habitable planets, which planet hunters like, because all you need to know is the star and the orbit of the planet. So this is something that a planet hunter can tell you, regardless of what technique they use. Whether it's microlensing or transits, RV, doesn't matter. So a planet hunter likes the idea of a habitable zone because they can get press releases saying that they found a planet in the habitable zone. People who actually study planets in detail know that the habitable zone is a rough cut at best, and it'd be sort of the equivalent of choosing your basketball team by just saying, I want everyone who's taller than 6 foot, something like that. Okay, it's a very rough cut. And there's, you know, in detail, Earth isn't even in the habitable zone, so it's weird. So what we want to do is get ground truth. So we want to look for water on the surface of a planet, so we can actually say that a planet is habitable in real life. So there's lots of different ideas that have been proposed for this. The one that I've labeled in red, they're looking for water vapor, has actually been done for hot Jupiters. So that's good. So we know there's a proof of principle there. Of course, hot Jupiters are not habitable, but at least we know that we can find water vapor in the atmospheres of exoplanets. You look for variable cloud cover, but so far that's still only telling you about water in the atmosphere of a planet. If you want it to be habitable, the real definition of habitability is having liquid water on the surface of the planet. Okay, so if you want to do that, you could look for the colors of water. So water tends to be bluish, as opposed to continents, which are reddish. You could look for glint from water, because water is smooth in a way that no other surface on Earth is. And related to glint, you could look for polarization. All right, and notice that for everything except for looking for water vapor, all those have to do with time variability. So that's time resolved photometry. That's not spectroscopy. Okay, maybe a few colors is good, but you're basically just talking about time variability. And this is something that I think has been largely neglected when thinking about characterizing exoplanets. Okay, so here's the pictures. Zoom forward 10, 20, 30 years, depending how optimistic you want to be. This is what you might see for a system at, let's say, 10 parsecs, and it's a solar system analog. All right, so you have this is with a star shade, right? So you know, cache is on this, so you know it's an external occulter, and you've got these two dots, and the one on the top left there is Earth, the blue one. That's the pale blue dot. So there's an Earth twin at 10 parsecs. And then the one on the right is Venus. And so the question is, what kind of science can you do with these unresolved dots? And there's these two options, right? You can do the spectroscopy, so you can look for water vapor or ozone, methane, those kinds of things in the atmosphere of this planet, or you could do time-resolved photometry, and you can guess which one I'm going to talk about. So what does time-resolved photometry for that object look like? Well, here's an example of what you might see. So there's two trends here. There's the broad trend over time, and in this case that would be for one orbital period. So over one orbital period, you're seeing the planet go through its phases. Okay, and this is something that we've observed with extrasolar planets at infrared wavelengths. And so this is already, again, there's the proof of principle. We've done this before for exoplanets at thermal wavelengths. But then when you're doing this at reflected wavelengths, there's this extra signal that you don't really see at thermal wavelengths, which is it's shown in the little inset there. If you zoom in on this, so apart from the phases of the planet, as you see the day side versus the night side of the planet as it orbits around its host star, you also see rotational variability or diurnal variations, right? That's due to the rotation of the planet, okay? And so that's shown it's more or less periodic, right, and that's due to continents and oceans and clouds and different surface features on this planet basically rotating in and out of view. So interestingly, the thing the kind of zeroth order thing you think you might know about an exoplanet, namely its albedo, what's the overall albedo of the planet, is actually the one thing we won't know for exoplanets, okay? Because there's a degeneracy between the size of the planet and how bright it is. So in the figure I showed you before this, you saw that Venus looked really bright, that big white blob, right? But the question was it bright because it's a bigger planet than Earth, or is it bright because it has a higher albedo? And you actually will not know that for exoplanets. Okay, so knowing the overall albedo is something we won't know. What you will know is how the albedo changes with time and how the albedo changes with wavelength, i.e. the spectrum, or roughly speaking, the colors. Okay, so that brings us to epoxy. So Micah Hearn was the PI of epoxy, which is basically epoch that Drake Deming was the lead of, and Dixie, which Micah Hearn was the lead of. And so this is, you take Deep Impact, and then after it smashed this big copper beer fridge into a comet, you're left with this perfectly functioning telescope, except it's not quite perfectly functioning. It's actually out of focus, but that turned out to be great for doing transit planet studies. So that's basically a large reason why this project was approved, is because it used this known issue with the spacecraft. Okay, so there's two parts of this, and Jesse is going to speak right after me about the number one topic there, which is to observe exoplanets, okay? And I'm not going to talk about that. What I'm going to talk about is number two, which is to observe Earth as an exoplanet. Okay, so this is what I'm showing here is what epoxy actually saw of Earth. It actually did it in seven wave bands, but here are four of them. And of course, for an exoplanet, unless you build a spacecraft the size of a mirror the size of a football field or even bigger, you're not actually going to see this. All you're going to see is just this. You can just see the light curve. So this is the time-resolved photometry I was talking about in these different wave bands. And so the question is, what can you learn just from those light curves? Okay, and here they are in a non-movie form. So we have seven wave bands going from the near UV down to the near IR here, and this is showing the bolometric variability. And this is over 24 hours. All right, so you're seeing this is just due to the rotation of Earth as it rotates around. And there's a solid line and a dashed line. Those are two different epochs. One of them was in March, and one was in June of 2008. All right, so what can we learn about Earth from those light curves? Well, it turns out there's two approaches here. One of them, which I think people have thought a little bit about both these, right? So I'm going to talk about this bottom approach first. So this is where you make a very fancy forward model of what Earth looks like. So you try and use realistic cloud cover, and you actually pay attention to where the clouds were on the day of your observations, and you take into account the scattering phase function of different kinds of surfaces on Earth. You take account of the glint and all these different parameters, and then you make a prediction of what the data ought to look like. And then that works great in the data-rich regime. If you have very good observations, as we do in this case, this is great. You know, you can say, how good are we at modeling Earth? You could ask, that's a reasonable question to ask. Are we good to 10%? Are we good to 50%? I mean, how good a job can we predict what Earth ought to have looked like on those days in March and June? The reverse question, which I think is more appropriate for what we're going to do with exoplanets, is the data-starved regime where you have crummy data, you make a few assumptions, and then you come out with a simple model. All right, so I'm going to talk about both of these in turn. Okay, so the predictive modeling. So this is work done by Ty Robinson and the Virtual Planet Laboratory. And so here, this is believe it or not, so if you're, yeah, I was shocked that there was actually this much discrepancy between the model in red and the data in black. But this is the best Earth model that exists for actually showing what the disk-integrated Earth looks like as seen from far away. And amazingly, there's actually still some discrepancy. So we can't actually model Earth perfectly. So that's a little caveat to have in the back of your head. But here are the variations over 24 hours and four of the wave bands.
What's going on at 150 degrees?
Oh, this is the start of the observations. And then it goes there, comes back, and then the clouds have changed. So that's why you get a little change there. So yeah, it's not continuous there. Yeah, exactly. So cloud change is somewhere between 2 and 5% over 24 hours on Earth.
Which is the reason that
the observation works probably. No, these models had cloud cover based on actual weather satellites. So they knew exactly where the clouds were, what altitude they were, whether they're ice or snow or liquid water. They knew all of that. Yeah, these models are obscenely detailed. Like, they make me want to barf. They're that detailed. Because I like doing the opposite thing. But anyway, so here you go. So this is just showing the overall, if you average over time, right, the overall intensity you're getting from the planet is pretty good. The model and the data agree, right? It's just when you're trying to match these diurnal variations, it gets trickier. And then here it is again for the June observations. And again, I mean, there's these some places where you know the best models that exist just can't do a very good job of modeling Earth. So this is good. This means that there's work to be done here. But overall, if you average over time, the data and the models agree. Okay, so that's the forward modeling. So that's if you wanted to make a model of Earth that was pretty good, and then say, okay, now if I go and look at an exoplanet, this is what I ought to see. Okay, that's the forward modeling. Now let's look at the backward modeling. Okay, this is if you have some data, and this is appropriate, especially if you have low signal to noise, crummy data, and you just want to try and interpret, what does that data tell me about this object? Okay, so the first thing that you do is you look at the time averaged spectrum. Okay, and here I have it in terms of albedo rather than intensity, which is why the shape is a little bit different. Okay, and there's a few things I want to point out here. So first of all, if you just look at the shape of this, the fact that it's blue on the left is just due to Rayleigh scattering, and then it's gray at longer wavelengths. All right, that's due to some combination of just the albedo spectra of clouds, which are basically gray. And then the blue is Rayleigh scattering, so that's why Earth looks blue from far away. It's not that we have oceans, it's just that we have Rayleigh scattering. The size of the error bars here, these aren't actually error bars. These are showing the RMS variability in those wave bands over 24 hours, right? And so what you should take away is that the largest variability is over here at red wavelengths. All right, and I'll come back to that in a moment. So the main concern at this point, looking at this, is that, okay, we've learned that Earth has clouds and Rayleigh scattering maybe. And we know that Earth has clouds, right? So in practice, in case you don't know this number, the number is something like 50%-ish, give or take. Okay, so at any given point in time, roughly 50% of Earth is covered in clouds. Okay, and clouds are the most reflective things on Earth. They're more reflective than continents, more reflective than oceans by a lot. So what can you possibly learn about the surface of this planet given that it's covered in clouds, right? Because we want to know the ground truth. Does this planet have liquid water on its surface? So the way we're going to try and tackle this is principal component analysis. And so for those of you who haven't seen this in a while, here it is in a nutshell. So say you take 10 observations of Earth in two different wave bands, wave band A and wave band B. All right, so you have this scatter plot, and you look there, and you see there's a bit of a pattern to where those points are scattered. So you can describe them by their mean, so the mean color of Earth in these two wave bands shown there. And then the principal components of those colors, right? So this is where you get into the PCA part. Okay, so you've got C1 down there. Most of the variations in the colors of Earth happen along that vector, and then C2 is not nearly as important. Okay, so that's the basic approach we're going to take here, because it turns out that it works really nicely for a computer to do it, and so you can do it in seven dimensions, and so you can make these eigencolors here. And The takeaway point of these eigencolors is that first of all, there's these two eigencolors that together describe about 98%, a little bit more than 98% of the color variations of Earth. Okay, so you might have thought that Earth, right, if you observe Earth in seven different wave bands, okay, that's the seven-dimensional parameter space, and you observe it at different points in time, you'd think it might just fill up that whole volume, and it could have this whole variety of different colors. But it turns out it doesn't. Okay, in this seven-dimensional wave, seven-dimensional space, Earth lives on this plane, basically, described by these two colors. Okay, so that means that the color changes on Earth come in basically two kinds. Either something changes at long wavelengths, which is shown with that red eigencolor, or something changes at short wavelengths, which is shown by the blue eigencolor. Right? And now knowing something about Earth, shown down here, you might wager a guess that when something changes at long wavelengths, that's because you're seeing land. Okay, so in a particular land that doesn't have clouds on it rotating in and out of view. When something changes at short wavelengths, it might be because oceans that are not covered in clouds are rotating in and out of view. And it turns out you might think you would get a different answer depending on what angle you were looking at Earth from. So what I just showed you was the equatorial view of Earth. Okay, so the spacecraft happened to be above the equator when it took those images. You could do this with the spacecraft more or less above the North Pole, or at least way above the Northern Hemisphere. And then you get this, which turns out this spectrum is actually very, very similar to the one I showed you before. If you look at the size of the error bars, you'll see it's actually slightly different. So you get more of the variations at blue wavelengths rather than red wavelengths. So you can see that if you do a principal component analysis, you find that the most important eigencolor is actually the solid black line there, which is very close to zero at long wavelengths and is very non-zero at short wavelengths.
How do you know the blue component is ocean, or at least you label it that way, instead of what I might have guessed, which would be variable cloud altitude?
different amounts of Rayleigh scattering. Yeah.
Does the ocean component in our calculations is pretty small? I'm surprised that it shows up.
Yeah, so I'm actually, for now, I'm being agnostic about what these are, right? I mean, these are actual real spectra of surface types, the ones that I've labeled. Up there, this is merely, you know, you're supposed to look there and say, oh yeah, well, if something is reflective at blue wavelengths, it can't be land, because land is black there. But you're totally right, and that's one of the big false positives for blue things rotating in and out of view, is that you just have different amounts of cloud cover, and so you get more or less Rayleigh scattering. So we talk about this in our actual paper. It turns out the important thing is variations at the red wavelengths, which are not dominated. At blue wavelengths, you're always screwed because of Rayleigh scattering. I mean, you basically can't see the surface of the planet. All you see at short wavelengths is either clouds or you just see this murky stuff. You can't see what the ground is. Yeah?
Could you constrain some of these components to vary the orbital period?
Yeah.
The planet, in other words, I mean,
yeah. Yeah, exactly, and that's in fact exactly what we do in the kind of the next step. So like in two slides you'll see what we do. So this is Earth from below. So now you're looking at Antarctica. Again, the spectrum looks very similar. So you shouldn't be, at first I think the people I talked to were actually kind of surprised that Earth actually looks the same regardless of what angle you look at it from. And it turns out that's not a big shocker, because the Rayleigh scattering is going to be more or less the same because we have an atmosphere everywhere on the planet. And there's clouds everywhere on the planet. And so that tells you what the overall spectrum of Earth ought to look like. And people thought, oh, well, geez, surely if you look at Earth from right below the South Pole, you're going to see a whole lot of Antarctica. It's going to look really bright or something. But remember, by definition, the sun does not illuminate the South Pole, right? The parts of Earth that are well illuminated are the tropics. And so if you do the combination of the parts of Earth that you see well, if you're below the South Pole, and the parts of Earth that the sun illuminates, you find some mid-latitude. You find a place like 45 degrees south of the equator. Right, and that's temperate, and so not surprisingly, Earth actually looks very temperate regardless of where you look at it from. And you can do the southern eigencolors, and here you actually do learn about the fact that there's big gray things rotating in and out of view, and that's shown by the solid line there, which is very very flat and non-zero everywhere. And so that's telling you the most important thing happening when you're looking at Earth from down there is actually there are gray things rotating in and out of view, namely Antarctica. Okay, so sorry, I lied. It was like four slides, not two slides. But the point is that now if you make an assumption, remember, this is a backward model, right? I'm not trying to make a physically realistic model of Earth and then predict what my data ought to have looked like. I'm saying I have this data, I'm going to make a few assumptions and try and extract some information about it, right? So the first thing I was trying to extract is how many different surfaces are there and roughly what do they look like? What are the colors of these principal surfaces on Earth? And now I'm going to make a bold assumption. I'm either going to assume the planet is entirely diffuse, Lambert reflection like on the top, or it's entirely specular, shiny reflection like this. It turns out I can actually do the next step in either limit. I just can't mix them really well. So if you look at you know, and these are fake pictures of Earth, but the point is that these were people who really cared about specular reflection. You see, that's the glint spot there. And then the rest of Earth is actually fairly well treated by diffuse reflection. And if you look in detail at the way people model Earth, that's generally the way they do it. They just assume that everything is diffuse Lambert reflection, except for water and in some cases clouds. Clouds can sometimes be non-diffuse as well. So basically what I'm going to do is just ignore specular reflection for now. And if I do that, then I can make a map. And this gets what you're saying, right? If I assume that those 24 hours of data, you know, that the surface features are actually tracking that, which they do, even clouds track land to first order, right? Otherwise the clouds would all be whizzing above our heads if they didn't track the land. So you can basically make a map. And this is showing a map of this is the most important eigencolor here. So this is showing sort of what's happening in the near infrared wavelengths. And so if you do this, you find that you can basically figure out, and again, this is showing the map for the equatorial view. So this is where the spacecraft was roughly above the equator, and the sun, by definition, was illuminating the tropics. And so you should really only limit your comparison of this map and that map to the stuff near the equator. And if you do that, you find it's not a horrible map. So you get the Pacific, the Americas, the Atlantic. The Sahara Desert really sticks out because there's no clouds over the Sahara Desert, so it looks really bright, and the rest of Eurasia. Okay, so...
Is that a plot on the bottom of the percent of land, which is what it says, or is it measurements?
It's measurements. That should be fraction.
Proud of the fact that you can't tell the difference, but I'm just wondering.
That's fraction of the number one principal eigencolor. Which we suspect, with hindsight, we suspect is associated with land because it describes things where the albedo changes at near IR wavelengths but doesn't change at near UV wavelengths.
Okay, but you labeled it percent land.
I did.
You mean it's percent of this eigencolor. It's a measured thing, not a...
It's a measured thing.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. So this is the best map you could hope to make. Those are actual observations, though. Okay, so that map looks pretty, it's kind of crummy. But in the very same issue of AppJ, right? So to put this in perspective, here's a different kind of map. Okay? This is from a different paper. They were making simulations. They wanted to try and simulate what the New Worlds Observer would see. And the point is that if they made a realistic simulation of what Earth looked like, and then they pretended that they had white light curves of that Earth over 24 hours, right? So it's a very, very similar experiment to us, except they were using simulated data rather than real data. Okay, what they find is this is the best map that they can get of Earth, as shown there, and then this is their reference map here. And so if you look back and forth between them, you see that they don't match at all, and that's in fact exactly what they say in their abstract. They conclude that if you have a white light curve of Earth, you actually cannot make a map of the planet. All right, and so it turns out the difference here is that they had used white light. They didn't have color information. And so although I'm a real advocate for time-resolved photometry, you also need a little bit of color information too, otherwise you run into some real problems. And I can talk at length about exactly why you need the color information. But the basic conclusions is that you want time resolved and multiband photometry, and that's a nice complement to time average spectroscopy, which is what most of us are sort of getting excited about for exoplanets. And one last note, it could be that depending on what kind of mission you want to invoke for getting these kinds of data from exoplanets, it could be that it's actually easier to get time-resolved photometry than it is to get spectroscopy, right? Because if you're trying to null the host star, sometimes it's easier to do that if you just limit it to some relatively narrow range of wavelengths, right? It's easier to null that star at just a narrow range of wavelengths than it is to do it at a whole wide range of wavelengths. So it could be that the first data we get of exoplanets will actually be time-resolved photometry, and so we have to think about what we can actually learn from that in a useful way. That's all I have, so I'll take any questions. And Anna can talk at length about epoxy or whatever you want. Yeah?
In your forward modeling, you commented that you were surprised on how large the errors are.
Yeah.
Can you comment on what the main sources of these errors are, or what we don't understand or know about from all those detailed data that you
can? I'm going out on a bit of a limb. That's work done by a graduate student at the University of Washington. But I'll wave my hands a little bit. So one of the things is that they assume in that really detailed forward model, they assume that all the land, all the things on land are diffuse reflectors. So they reflect kind of like a Lambert sphere. They do water separately. So water has specular glint. They do that properly, and they actually do clouds properly as well. So they take into account the actual scattering phase function of clouds. But they assume that land is a diffuse reflector. So that's a big assumption. And there are observations of that you can do. It just hasn't been implemented into this model. So that's one of the big ones for these light curves. That I can throw out there, but
On the first thing, models, clouds, and I suspect I don't have insight into how they did it, but it's really tough to model clouds. And in this case, I would ask what assumptions and what knowledge did they start with? If it's just some kind of information on a cloud map, cloud over here and cloud over there, that knowledge is probably too crude to be able to make a good reflection model. There's so many parameters that go into reflectivity of the cloud, including how thick it is, what the particle sizes are, how high it is in the atmosphere, and all kinds of things that I would think would be very difficult to get close to, from the model calculation to an observation of the global albedo, just from knowledge of where the clouds are and where they're not.
Yeah.
I think that's a pretty good thing, actually.
Right, yeah, no, so the first version of that, so I didn't even show their first attempts at fitting this. So their first attempts were so bad that they're not worth making a slide for. What changed was actually the cloud. So that's what, it took about a year to get this good of a fit, and they went from having, they used to have a single cloud. It was Boolean. It was either you had a cloud or you didn't have a cloud, and they just took some like kind of average cloud. And this version has, I think, six different kinds of clouds. And so they actually, they look at the satellite information and they pay attention to how the altitude of the clouds and what kind of cloud it is. And so they have six different kinds, which is still coarse, right? It's not, they don't have a full spectrum of clouds, but it's gotten a lot better. So the data with a single kind of cloud was terrible. So you're absolutely right. I think clouds really do dominate. If you want to do this forward modeling, you need to get the clouds correct.
It's very tough. Clouds are the toughest thing to model. Climate models are the source of the largest uncertainty we have right now in climate models.
But at the same time, for the backward modeling problem for TPF, understanding clouds at the 30% level, which is sort of what I saw there, would be just an enormous advance. I mean, understanding that it has clouds that come and go would be just, 100% success.
Right.
I don't know what the main difference we've got to make this measurement toward the Earth.
What was the range of the spacecraft?
Well, the distance where you were looking toward the Earth. What were you at that time?
Oh, I mean, the spacecraft was still in basically a heliocentric orbit with at like 1 AU, and so it was taking images of Earth more or less at quadrature, which is of order 1 AU away, with some trig factor in there. So it was pretty far from Earth. They could still resolve Earth, and so we just had them squinch it down into a single pixel for this experiment, but. And the actual press release, you can see a little video of Earth rotating around. No, I didn't show any videos.
So you didn't say anything about the red edge.
Yeah.
That component that you see, that red component there, is the reflective, the enhanced red reflective component of vegetation on Earth.
So we did play around with looking for the red edge at one point, and we found if you continue this principal component analysis, you look at the next eigencolors, I think that, so what I showed were numbers 1 and 2, the first most important ones, but if you looked at 3 and 4, those both had features that seemed to be associated with rainforests rotating in and out of view. Unfortunately, if you look at the amplitude of those eigenvectors, they're right down at like the 2% level, which is right where cloud variability is. I think that's basically the same result as the consensus in the community seems to be that like, yeah, you can do red edge if you're lucky. It's like, it's hairy, right? It's like right at the edge.
Well, I remember writing in our lunar reflection paper when we did this modeling that it was kind of dicey as to whether or not you could see it or not. But if there's fewer clouds and you have more vegetation.
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And so a number of people are complaining that this is an almost impossible thing, but I think if you have a slightly different kind of Earth,
yep,
that it might be a strong signal.
Yeah, no, and if you look at the thing, the red edge is sort of the same as the glint signal, which is another idea that's been proposed a lot. If you look at the disk integrated light, it screams out. You can see the glint in the videos. You can see the red edge. If you look at the right wave bands that are next to each other, you see, oh my God, that's this glowing thing, and you look at the map and you say, oh, that's the Amazon. So when you see the whole disk, it's there. But then when you squinch it down to a single pixel, the question is how much does that contribute to the total light? And then it's like it's just at the hairy edge for Earth. But you're right, for another planet, it would be bigger. Could be.
I think part of that issue is that you're using broadband filters, and if you want to look at an edge, it's better to look on both sides of the edge with narrowband filters. And I guess I would bet if you did that, your amplitude, your principal component would come out a lot higher for that edge.
Yeah.
So a lot depends on specific technique.
Yeah. And again, from an observational standpoint, it could be it's easier to do narrowband. I mean, if you're going to try and do, if you want to do the first you know, a Coulter or a coronagraph or something, it could be easier to do it in a very limited range of wavelengths. So. Ish, yeah.
Is there similar data on the MOS or if we could
try that? Yeah, so we got Epoxy did observations of Mars. It was easy to convince them because the rotational period is basically the same as Earth. So we just said, do exactly what you did for Earth, but do it for Mars. And I have not looked at those data. I think they're like in my inbox somewhere, but I haven't even made a plot of them yet. But yeah, that would be a great control to just convince ourselves that Mars looks very different from Earth. Because Earth actually looks very similar from seen even from different angles. So.
Well, the principal complex would be like that red one there on the Mars, the red.
Well, yeah, but if it's always the same hue of red, then your yeah. Your principal components would be zero, basically, because it just nothing changes.
If the first exoplanet was a Venus, one might be perhaps a little disappointed.
Yes. Yeah, no, you're right, yeah, there'd be...